Breadbox Media Programming is brought to you by...
We've got good news. The world is open again, and people like you, people of faith, are traveling to Catholic sites around the world. Want to travel with exceptional Catholic leaders this fall, next year, or in the future? Are you looking to see specific sites, celebrate traditional Latin Mass, or travel to destinations without vaccine requirements? We are here to help you deepen your faith on pilgrimage. Give us a call at 1-800-842-4842 or visit us online at selectinternationaltours.com. Select International Tours is your pilgrimage company, and we have the perfect Catholic trip for you.
Are you looking to serve God and society? Consider putting your gifts to work as a lawyer. Ave Maria School of Law has been educating faith-filled lawyers for over 20 years. Ave Maria School of Law is committed to training lawyers to use law appropriately around the moral issues of our time. Visit avemarialaw.edu to learn more about integrating your faith with a law degree.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. It's open forum today. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. Carlo Broussard is our guest. Your calls are welcome, 888-318-7884. You can only call if you're not Catholic or if you are Catholic. Those are the only two categories that can call, 888-318-7884. Everybody else, don't bother. Don't bother dialing if you don't fit into one of those two categories. And you can ask about any Catholic doctrine you want to know about. You want to know about the Trinity? I don't know if we've had any atheist or agnostic people call yet. Today, but though you always enjoy those conversations.
Yeah, sure.
Maybe, why do you believe in God? Or, why do you have certainty in your belief in God when we should just all be agnostics, maybe? Some people have. That's not my view. I don't want you to think that's my view, Carlos. That came out like that was my view, but whatever. Or maybe you have a very particular Catholic doctrine, like the doctrine of the Communion of Saints, as we discussed last hour. 888-318-7884 is the number. 888-31-TRUTH. Darren still out on paternity leave. Lucy Rose is 1 week and 2 days old. No, 3 days old. 1 week and 3 days old today.
Amazing. So, beautiful. Yeah. So happy for him.
I can still do so much stuff better than she can. That's going to go on for a while, I think. Makes me feel good to be able to do stuff better than babies. 888-318-7884. But while Darren's out, Sarah has been from the development office.
She's killing it
over
there.
She's killing it.
Metaphorically
speaking. No, she hasn't. Yeah, she's not actually killing anything, but she's running that soundboard really, really well. So thanks, Sarah. The sound is going out right now, right, Sarah? Okay, all right, good. I couldn't tell by the look on your face, but all right, back to the phones we go. Little baby Lucy Rose. That's nice to think about, a little tiny little baby. That's number 5 for Darren and Rena.
Yeah, they got their hands full, that's for sure.
They do, yeah.
Joyful.
Joyful. Oh, I like that.
Yeah. Hands full, but it's joyful.
It is. But we haven't heard from Darren. So joyful as it is, it might also be depriving him of sleep. Sarah, you communicated with him one, and he did respond to your email. Yeah. 888-318-7884. Let's go to Ruben over there in Indiana, listening on Sacred Heart Radio. Hang on a quick second, Ruben. Ruben, are you there with us?
Will you go to heaven if you get blessed before you die?
That is such a good question.
Yes,
but I was hoping we would say hello first, Ruben. So hello. Boy, you got right to it.
Sorry.
Jimmy Akin would love that. Yeah. He loves it when people get right to their question. But Ruben, you sound young. What are you, about 15, 14? How old are you, Ruben?
I am actually 7 years old.
Wow. 7? Wow.
Ruben,
you're
very
advanced.
Articulate, buddy.
All right. Did you get the question from Ruben?
Yes. So, will you go straight to heaven if you get blessed before you die? Well, Ruben, it's possible. And we can say that it's more likely, you have a better chance, right, of going straight to heaven if you get blessed by a priest and receive the sacraments before you die. Now, we don't know for sure if that person's going to go straight to heaven, but it is possible, and that person's going to have a better chance. The church teaches us that it's possible that we can die, Reuben, with such a deep, deep, deep love for Jesus, and a true, 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 deep, deep repentance of our sins, so that whenever we die, there's no need to be purified and go through what we call purgatory before entering into heaven, but that we could just go straight to heaven because there's no more purification that's needed for the person. And that could be the result of receiving the priestly blessing before dying and receiving the sacraments. So this is why, Reuben, people who are almost about to die, this is why they call in the priests to bless them and to receive those sacraments, because it's increasing the likelihood or their chances of dying with such a pure soul and a strong degree of love for Jesus that they would go straight to heaven. So it's possible, buddy, and it increases the likelihood or our chances of going straight to heaven.
Okay, Reuben?
Yeah.
All right.
Okay, thank you.
Well, thank you. You're very excellent. You're very polite, and you really do a good job talking on the radio. And maybe we'll get to talk with you again. I'm going to keep moving. Let's see. Let's go to Adam in Pleasantville, New York, watching on YouTube. Adam, go ahead with your question for Carlo. Oh, hang on, Adam. I pushed the wrong button. Adam?
Hi. How you doing? Can you hear me?
I can. Yes. Go ahead with your question, Adam.
Hi. All right. No, I just had a quick question about the passage in 1 Corinthians 7, I believe.
Yeah.
Where St. Paul's saying that nobody or no man should get engaged that isn't already engaged. And I was kind of confused about that because, you know, I'm reading the Bible. I'm a single guy in his 30s, and I see that, and I was like, well, you know, I thought marriage was a big thing. So I was just kind of curious about that.
Yeah, very good question, Adam. So what we are not to take away from this passage is that Paul is forbidding single men to marry, such that if they were to marry, they would be contravening God's law or something, okay? And I'm pretty sure that you understand that. So that is not what how we are to interpret it. And one key to this is found in verse 25, where St. Paul had already talked about, you know, if with regard to widows, that it was well for them or good for them to remain single as he does. That's with regard to widows. But then in verse 25, he says, now concerning the unmarried, that would be you, I have no command of the Lord, but I give my opinion as one who by the Lord's mercy is trustworthy. And that's a key for interpreting the text there, 1 Corinthians 7:25, Adam, that this is Paul's prudential advice or wisdom, his opinion given to those who are unmarried, to remain as they are, as he is. Why? He goes on to give the reasoning. Are you bound to a wife? Do not seek to be free. Are you free from a wife? Do not seek marriage. But if you marry, you do not sin. So it's not a sin to marry. And if a girl marries, she does not sin. Yet those who marry will have worldly troubles, and I would spare you of that. So basically, Adam, what Paul is saying is, hey, look, if you're unmarried, That's a really good thing, because you can be entirely devoted to the Lord and without any sort of division of the heart of having to take care of wife and children and somehow taking you away from your devotion to the Lord and being divided in your attention and in your zeal and desire. So he's saying, hey, that's a super good thing to be entirely devoted to the Lord. So if you're in that state, I recommend go ahead and stay in that state. That's a great thing, lest you have to experience the trouble of being divided for the Lord. But if you discern that God is calling you to marriage, that is not sinful, nor is it a bad thing. It is a good thing. But, Adam, being married, as good as it is, even the church teaches this, would be, objectively speaking, a less good than the good of consecrated celibacy, where you're consecrating your life to the Lord in a celibate state. That does not mean everyone is called individually to the celibate state for the kingdom of God. God calls some people to the married life. And if one discerns that God is leading them to that state, you recognize within yourself, yeah, I have a great desire. I think I can succeed at being a good husband and a good father, and that is what the Lord is seemingly calling you to, then that is a good that you ought to try and pursue. If someone chooses to forego that good, the good of marriage, in order to pursue an objectively higher good, consecrated celibacy for the kingdom of God, well, then that's a higher good. That's a great calling, a higher calling, objectively speaking, which some are called to, although not all. Kind of like Adam, the rich man. Think of like the rich man. You know, our Lord tells the rich man or the rich young man, Matthew 19, go sell everything you have and come and follow me. Well, surely our Lord does not intend for every disciple to sell everything they have in order to follow him. That was a specific calling for that individual young man. Similarly, what's going on with St. Paul here is he's giving instruction like, hey, the unmarried state objectively is a higher good because you can be entirely devoted to the Lord and not be divided with your attention and your desire and zeal. But that doesn't mean marriage is not a good. It just means it's a lesser good, which some people in God's providence are called to. And so that's how I would articulate that passage. Is that helpful for you, brother?
Yes, it's very helpful. Thank you so much. Well, it's good to know because, a guy in his 30s makes me feel a little better.
Yeah, absolutely, brother. If you're desiring to be married, my friend, and you think that God is calling you to that, go for it.
All right. Thanks a lot, guys.
Okay.
Thank you very much, Adam. Maybe there's somebody named Eve in New York. That was dumb. I bet he's probably heard that 1,000 times.
Probably so.
Sometimes you can't resist a really, really dumb joke. Well, I can't resist. We'll take a quick break. We'll be right back. The lines are full, by the way, so lots of good questions to come up for Carlo. It's open forum. We'll be right back with that after this on Catholic Answers Live.
Your questions, Catholic Answers Live. Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects homebuyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
Hi, friends. Jonet Williams here. Join me every Wednesday on Women of Grace Live as I welcome New Age researcher and blogger for Women of Grace, Sue Brinkman. Sue and I will be talking about all the wacky things that could distract you from your faith. Psychics, yoga, Reiki, crystals, acupuncture, Ouija boards, tarot cards, and astral traveling are just a few of the stranger things we discuss. That's why we call it Wacky Wednesday. So join us tomorrow at 11 a.m. Eastern on EWTN Radio.
Bill Coleman back to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. Carla Broussard is our guest. Let me just check how many people are on the phone lines. 1 million. There's 1 million people on the lines. So back to work we go. Ryan, right out here in California, watching on YouTube. Go ahead, Ryan, with your question for Carla.
Hello. So my question is about specifically the canonization of saints. And I know that part of that process in the Catholic Church is you have this discerning that's done, you test, and, you know, if good fruits and if good works come from, you know, prayer or devotion to the saint, then that means that this person can be canonized. But my question is, I know that idea of testing the spirit comes from a Bible verse, but should that really be the interpretation of it? And the reason I say this is because of one specific example that I've seen recently of people who practice witchcraft praying to Mary as though she is a goddess. So my question would be, you know, they say that they're seeing this increase in good fruits because of their prayer, but from a Catholic perspective, well, if they're praying to her as a goddess, then they'd be sinning. So, you know, can we say that the canonization process is, you know, effective or accurate? And if so, how can we say that?
Okay. All right, Ryan, this is a really insightful question, and I appreciate it, buddy. So with regard to the witchcraft and praying to Mary as a goddess and good fruits coming from that, my first response would be, well, we have to analyze the quote-unquote good fruits and what they are, because there are some things that can be good from the perspective of an earthly life, like riches or power or anything within this world, that Satan can also bring about And demons can also bring about through the influencing of others, right? And messing with their imagination and tempting them, etc. So just because there are good fruits, that doesn't necessarily mean that whatever the practice is being done is like a good practice. Because the quote-unquote good fruits could be earthly goods, but not necessarily spiritual or religious goods, right? And our Lord would not bring about religious goods for idolatry if someone is worshiping a creature. The good, and this actually leads to how we analyze the quote-unquote goods that would come from the invocation of a particular saint. What I mean by that is somebody like asking a saint to pray for them. The specific goods that the church looks for in discerning whether this person is in heaven or not before it makes an infallible statement that the person is in heaven, the specific goods are miracles, right? These are goods that cannot possibly be brought about by a creaturely power. And this is why the church takes great care in assessing these things. And so for canonization purposes, like to declare that this person is in heaven and for the universal church to honor this person as in heaven, two miracles through the intercession of these saints' prayers is required. And basically what that means is say, hey, I got this problem, I'm dying, I pray to this saint, and all of a sudden I have this miraculous healing, right? Something like that. And the church looks at these wondrous effects and is analyzing them saying, okay, could this have been brought about through any natural causation? Could this have been brought about from any quote-unquote supernatural causation? What I mean by that is like something over and above human beings, namely purely spiritual beings, whether righteous or unrighteous. Because not all wondrous effects require divine power. If I start levitating here in the room, Ryan, that doesn't necessitate that like God is doing that. A pure spiritual being like an angel, whether righteous or unrighteous, could be bringing about that effect. So the church is analyzing these good fruits, namely miracles, and saying only God can be bringing about these wondrous effects. And because God brought about these wondrous effects, i.e. miracles, directly in association with the invocation of the saint and asking the saint to pray for the healing and to intercede, the church comes to the conclusion, the reasonable conclusion, like, yeah, this person is in heaven. And then you have the Pope exercising formally the gift of infallibility in declaring such a soul to be in heaven. And as many of the theological manuals, for example, Ludwig Ott, even St. Thomas Aquinas would argue that the infallible declaration of a saint to be in heaven sort of flows from the dogma of the faith that the saints are to be venerated, that is honored, and invoked as set forth in the profession of faith of the Council of Trent. And so the correlative power of that is the power to canonize. And so as the theological tradition asserts that the Pope and recently, this as of 1960-something, the Congregation for the Doctrine of Faith in his commentary on the Professio Fidei identified canonizations as an infallible act of the Pope. And there we would no longer have we would no longer have probable knowledge that the saint is in heaven or the soul is in heaven, but that we would have an absolute certainty that the soul is in heaven based upon the infallibility of the Pope and the promise that Christ makes concerning his church with these issues. Is that helpful for you, Ryan?
Yeah, so in other words, it's not like the Pope is just making a good guess based on what he sees happening. It's, you know, because he holds the keys to the kingdom, you know, even if he weren't to observe the processes that take place in the process of canonization, he'd still be correct.
That's right, yeah. So, I mean, you have the reasonable judgment aspect of it, but then you have on top of that the perfection of that reasonable judgment, namely the infallible declaration. And of course, that presupposes or assumes that he has such an authority to do so, right? And that's where we would, you know, have further conversation about the evidence for that kind of authority. But the reasonable judgment goes first, and then you have the infallible declaration after that. If the Pope did not have such an authority, well, then we would just simply be left with a guess, whether uneducated or educated, right? Somebody who just says, oh, yeah, I believe this person is in heaven. That would be an uneducated, you know, a non-informed guess. But like, let's say all the diocesan, groups or whoever does the canonization process and investigating whether that particular soul is in heaven with the miracles and stuff, they would have these miracles and saying, yeah, these miracles are a direct result of these intercessions, but without the infallible declaration of the Pope concerning this, that would just simply be an educated guess.
Ryan, I'm going to leave it there. Thank you very, very much for the call. There's a couple lines open now, 888-318-7884. Next, we go to Oklahoma. Listening on Oklahoma Catholic Radio is River. Hang on a second. River, are you there with us?
Hi.
Hi, River. Hello, River. I'm so happy you're here. How old are you, River?
Oh, no. We lose him.
Oh, no. We did lose him. I didn't do it. River, you call right back. I do not know who to blame. I know who I want to blame, but I can't say Edgar's name and blame him.
That's unfortunate. Hopefully he calls back.
No, it just got it went quiet, and then the line just disappeared.
Whoever's there with
River.
Him, mama or daddy,
sorry.
Redial that number.
All right, so then who do I got left? Okay, I'll go to Chet in Columbus, Ohio, listening on 820 a.m. Let's all together now try not to hang up on Chet. Here we go. Hey, Chet, are you there?
I certainly am. Good evening, everyone.
Good evening, Chet. Go ahead with your question.
Man, it sounds like you're talking into a high-quality microphone there.
I know. He does sound good, huh?
Well, thank you. Thank you. I'm interested in hearing your opinion on a video I recently watched that kind of took me by surprise. It was a video called Vatican II, 60 Years Later. And it was on a website called Church Militant.
I'm
sorry.
No, that's okay. Usually we don't give out websites, but we're familiar with Church Militant, so that's all right. Go ahead.
Before the video started, I thought, okay, they're going to really beat up on Vatican II, and you know, a lot of Catholics, you talk about Vatican II, and they kind of cringe. But what was interesting is the video. They basically talked, and they said, if you really read Vatican II, it's actually a good message. The problem is the local churches have not done a good job of conveying what is actually said in Vatican II to the parishioners. Mm. So I was kind of surprised by that. They said, "Hey, Vatican II is legitimate. You know, the Pope called the bishops and." It, you know, a lot of people try to point fingers at it, but really, a lot of people are talking about it and they're uneducated about it. And they said it really goes down to the local level. The local churches just have not done a good job of conveying the actual message of Vatican II. So I was curious of your opinion on that.
Well, Chet, I haven't watched the video, so I'm only going to respond based upon how you articulated it here. And given that your articulation is correct of what was being said on the video, I would agree. I would agree that the Second Vatican Council is a legitimate ecumenical council, and that the actual message of the council and what the council taught on the variety of spectrum of the different levels of church teaching, from infallible to non-infallible, is right, good, and holy. And that the problem, as you articulated, is indeed with a failure to appropriately catechize and teach Catholics about what the Second Vatican Council actually teaches, whether it be about the church, whether it be about our relationship with other religions, whether it be about the sacred liturgy itself, that everything that is taught at the Second Vatican Council is in continuity, essentially, with what came before it. As is often said, how it's important that we approach Vatican II with a hermeneutic of continuity, as opposed to discontinuity. And of course, there are some who will say, nope, there's discontinuity, and they have specific issues that they would put forward, and we can debate that and go back and forth as to whether whether these elements are in continuity with the tradition or not. I would say that they are, but of course that would require more time and effort to go through the individual issues. But often it's sort of within the popular mindset of Catholics that since Vatican II, for example, we no longer believe that the Catholic Church is the true original church, which has the fullness of truth and life, but rather other Christian communities or sort of a different flavor of Christianity, as one caller put it earlier today on the broadcast. Some kind of have that in their popular consciousness, like this is kind of what Second Vatican Council is all about, where it's just kind of weakening the Catholic claim to be the one true church, but nothing could be further from the truth. For example, as the Catholic, the Second Vatican Council puts it in its dogmatic constitution on the church, Lumen Gentium, that the fullness of truth and life subsists in the Catholic Church, and that the Catholic Church is the one true church established by Jesus Christ. And so that's just one example among many, Chet, where you have sort of this popular idea that the Second Vatican Council was weakening many of the Catholic claims, when in fact they are not. So another example that comes to mind is, you know, in its documents on our relationships with other religions, as if it were to say that one religion is just as good as another. And within ecumenism, the idea is that one religion is just as good as another, and we can't really make any truth claims about our church over and above other claims by other religions. But again, nothing could be further from the truth, because in its teaching about ecumenism and entering into conversation and dialogue with other religions, it teaches that we must always hold fast to the truth that the Catholic Church was established by Jesus Christ and never waver on that, while at the same time lending a listening ear to what other people got to say.
Chet, thanks very, very much for the question. We will have to take a quick break, as you can hear, and hopefully we'll get River back from Oklahoma. Did River call back? I cannot wait to talk to River from Oklahoma right after this on Catholic Answers Live. The recent decision by the U.S. Supreme Court to overturn Roe v. Wade was a monumental victory for the pro-life movement. But the fight is far from over. With our new booklet, Why We're Pro-Life, we have produced the perfect tool to prepare you to have peaceful and convincing conversations to shed light on the truth about human life from conception to natural death. Catholic Answers is printing millions of copies of this booklet, and we plan simply to give them away. You can help us in two ways. First, by generously supporting this project. 25 cents prints one book. $2,500 prints 10,000, and so on. Second, by helping us distribute the booklet through your parish, your school, or the pro-life ministry you work with. Catholic Answers is going to blanket the country with Why We're Pro-Life, but only if you step up and help us. Thank you so much. For more information, visit whyweareprolife.com.
Want to know more about the origins of the Catholic Church? Joe Heschmeyer explores the beginnings of Christianity. In the early church was the Catholic Church. Joe digs deep into the words and actions of those who lived right after the apostles to refute anti-Catholic claims of how the faith was lived back then. Order your copy of The Early Church Was the Catholic Church today at shop.catholic.com or get it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
As Catholic apologetics have gotten stronger, Protestant responses have gotten stronger as well. And now they have their own answers to rebut the standard Catholic proofs. Don't fret, we've got you covered. In his new book, Meeting the Protestant Response, apologist Carlo Broussard gives well-reasoned biblical answers to Protestant comebacks. Order your copy of Meeting the Protestant Response today at shop.catholic.com or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Hey, it's Anna Mitchell. Tomorrow morning on the Sunrise Morning Show, we'll tell the incredible story of the witness of St. Isaac Jogues, St. Jean de Brebeuf, and the other North American martyrs to celebrate their feast day. Now back to Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back. Catholic Answers Live. I will tell you once again, you might be one of those people who's sitting around going, I'm looking for really great deals on Catholic books. Well, if that is you, We've got great deals on Catholic books, videos, other media. Just go to shop.catholic.com. Hundreds of great deals. Check them out today because it's our annual fall sale. And every year, the fall sale comes around at the same time. And now is the time for it. 10 to 25% off. In some cases, more than 25% off. Shop.catholic.com. Now the moment the entire world has been waiting for. River is back. River, we're glad you're here. Are you there with us, River?
I'm River.
Hi, River. How old are you?
I'm 7.
I'm sorry we got disconnected before.
Yeah, just some technology happened somehow.
River, you are a cool dude, a cool cucumber. Good for you. Thanks for rolling with the punches. But go ahead with your question for Mr. Broussard.
Okay, my question is, why did the Catholic Church split apart from the Orthodox Church?
Wait a second. You're 7 years old and you're just sitting around thinking about stuff and you're like, why did they... Are you a very high-level guy? Are you studying high-level theology, River?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm just trying to... I've been wondering about this for a pretty long time, so I wanted to know the answer.
That's pretty long time,
amazing.
Huh?
Amazing.
All right,
you must be getting some good Catholic education.
You are, or some even... good Orthodox education. We don't know which side he's coming at this from.
That's right.
All right, River, here comes your answer from Carlo.
Well, River, there are many, many issues. There are several issues that will Catholics and Orthodox will dispute and argue over and disagree on. But among those issues, the ranked number one issue is the authority of the successor of St. Peter, namely the Bishop of Rome, the Pope, and what kind of authority that he has over other members of Christ's church here on earth. That's the central or highest ranked issue that separates us as Catholics from our Orthodox brothers and sisters. Now, River, as Catholics, we would try to make our case, we would try to argue, we would try to explain to people that our Orthodox brethren were the ones who separated themselves from the original church established by Jesus because they decided, they chose, they believe that they should not look to the Bishop of Rome, the successor to St. Peter, as having a supreme or universal authority over all the Christians here on earth. So think of like a shepherd and the flock of the shepherd, okay? Our Catholic understanding, River, is that just as Jesus is the shepherd of every single Christian here on earth, past, present, and future, Jesus actually appointed Peter and his successors, the bishops of Rome, to be visible universal shepherds, shepherds that we can see and know, that would be shepherds of all the sheep of Jesus here on earth. That's you and me, River, as Christians. And so that's what we claim as Catholics. That's our belief, that the Pope is this universal shepherd of all Christians. And because of that, River, he has a special, unique role and an authority that he can exercise over all the sheep of Jesus here on earth in the Christian church. And that is a truth that our Orthodox brothers do not agree with. They would deny that the Pope, the Bishop of Rome, is the universal shepherd. He's a shepherd, but not the universal shepherd. And having authority and being the shepherd of all Jesus' sheep here on earth in a way that he could exercise authority over some other bishop in some other part of the world. And so that's the key issue, River, that separates us over and above even the other issues that we disagree on. So hopefully that's helpful for you, buddy.
River, thank you very much for the call.
You're welcome. Thank you so much for answering that.
Oh, you're a good man. I hope we'll get to talk with you again. Thank you again. I'm going to go to another caller, but I got to let you know there's lots of lines open right at the moment. It just so happens they kind of cleared up. So if you got a question about the Catholic faith, whether you're Catholic or not, you're very welcome here. 888-318-7884. I'm going to go to Cullen in Mississippi now, listening to EWTN on Channel 130. Sirius XM Satellite Radio. Cullen, thank you for your call. Go ahead with your question for Carlo.
Thank you. So my question is, well, first I'm just going to say, I love to joke around and laugh, and especially like playing with my younger siblings and stuff like that. But anyway, and I want to glorify God in all that I do.
Absolutely.
How can I joke and not sin? You know, how do I like discerning when humor is sinful?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, that's a great question, Cullen. I don't have sort of an on the spot ready answer to that question. I haven't really thought much about it. I do know that, for example, St. Thomas Aquinas has some parts in his Summa Theologiae where he talks about joking and how that's important and how humor is something that belongs to us as human beings, and part of living the good life and a happy life is to have humor in our lives. And so Aquinas has some interesting things to say about it. Unfortunately, I can't think of the exact place in the Summa Theologiae where he talks about this stuff. So you might just want to Google Thomas Aquinas on humor or joking and see what comes up. And that might direct you to some helpful information. So I know it's out there. I just can't give you the specific place where it's at. But initially, Colin, just off the cuff, I think there are a few guiding principles that we can articulate. And three come to mind just right on the spot. We want to be sure that whatever joke that we're telling or whatever sort of humor we're engaging in, it's not making light of sin. And the reason why I say that is because remember, Cullen, how our Lord says in the Beatitudes, blessed are those who mourn, right? So happy are those who mourn. And what is he talking about? Those who mourn over sin, right? Anything that's a violation of God's divine design, namely sin, it's not something that should give us joy, but it's something that we should mourn over. So that would be one guiding principle that I would think that I should use in discerning the goodness of my humor. Another thing, another guiding principle, is that we need to make sure that our humor avoids sinful speech, like using vulgar language within the joke, language that would bring with it certain concepts that are conflicting with God's divine design or God's plan or God's law, right? So just vulgar language that would bring with it a message of sinfulness. We need to try and make sure that our jokes are void or staying away from using sinful speech. And then one other guiding principle that comes to mind immediately, Colin, is that we need to make sure that our jokes do not fail in charity toward the person to whom we're joking with, if the joke is directed at somebody. As you said, you like to, you know, pick around with folks and make them laugh or whatever. So assuming that the joke, sort of the humorous behavior, is directed to the person, we need to make sure that the behavior is not failing somehow in charity, like we're not doing something to the person that would be contrary to their dignity as a human being or dehumanizing them in any way. We want to make sure that our behavior towards them is indeed charitable. Humor does not mean lack of charity. You can have charitable humor. We just have to make sure that we're taking into consideration what's good for the human person, their dignity as a human being, and then we're not dehumanizing them in any way. And I know those are sort of generalized principles and they're pretty abstract, but I would have to sit down with sort of an individual circumstance or like one example and then think through it. Because not all humor is the same, and so it's going to be dependent upon the individual circumstances, the person to whom you're talking, what's being said, and we're going to have to take all of that into consideration when we're morally analyzing whether the humor is moral or immoral. But those are at least three guiding principles that come to mind right off the bat.
What do you think, Colin?
That was well said. I appreciate it.
It was well said, but it also sounds like it requires tremendous discernment to know if you're meeting those.
It's extremely complex because the moral life is complex, right? I mean, there are some things that are pretty easy, black and white, but there are other things that are very difficult to think through because you have to know the relevant principles, right?
Yeah.
They're going to govern our analysis of certain behavior. But that humor is a good thing, and I would encourage Colin to continue in that humor because that's something that brings great joy and even perfection to human beings. And some people are better at it than others, and apparently Colin's got a natural gift for it. So I would recommend that Colin keep at it.
I'll tell you what, Edgar, this is what we'll do. Colin can have any one of Carlo's books that he wants. All right, I'm going to put him on hold. And then, Colin, thanks for the call. I'd love you to have any one of Carlo's books that you'd like. I love calls like that where we really don't get very many on that topic. Mm-hmm. It's challenging to think about. I do not like a lot of joking around, though. I think it's a waste of
that
time.
That is humor.
We'll be right back. Catholic Answers Live.
Hang on. Catholic Answers Live will return in a moment.
St. John Paul II stated that, for the disciple of Christ, evangelization is a duty, an obligation of love. And the Catechism of the Catholic Church states that evangelization is necessary for salvation.
So we know we're called, but how do we do it?
St. Paul Street Evangelization can help. To learn more, contact us at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
How are you listening to EWTN Radio right now? Have you ever wished you could listen on a local radio station? Maybe our Lord is speaking to your heart to help make that happen. Don't let a lack of experience hold you back. Find out how you can help start a Catholic radio station where you live. Powered by the truth of the church and EWTN's dynamic radio programming. Email Steve at this address, radio@EWTN.com.
Welcome back, Catholic Answers Live. Back to having a full phone, so off back to the phones we go. In New Windsor, New York, Juan in New Windsor, New York, listening on the EWTN app. Juan, we're glad you're here. Go ahead with your question for Carlo.
Thank you so much. My question is whether the devil has the ability to affect a soul of a baby before being born, or right after being born, before being baptized.
Wow.
What do you mean by affect the baby?
The reason why I'm asking is, I don't know if I should go into this, but I guess I made my own conclusion where you know, souls become broken, and they have, like, some people just don't have a chance in life to straighten themselves. Let's say somebody, somebody who is gay, for example. Is that the effect of the devil going into that soul and making that person gay and not having the chance to straight.
I just want to, before Carlo answers, there is some danger with this question that I want to be careful about, because we know of a lot of cases, and this is, I'm not at all accusing you of this, Juan, but there are unbalanced people in the world who have abused children with the notion that the child had the devil in them or something like that. Right. So I want to
Okay.
And like I said, Juan, that is not for you, but anybody who would consider doing such a thing needs to get help, because that is absolutely forbidden, that a child should ever be abused because someone thought there was a devil involved. But with that caveat, can you give Juan an answer?
Yeah, so Juan, this is a pretty complicated question that perhaps there are others who are more well-trained in these areas than I am. But a couple of thoughts that come to mind. We do know for sure that the devil, whether we're talking about an infant in the womb or us as grown adults, cannot directly affect the soul of a human being. The devil does not have access to the spiritual aspect or principle of the human being, namely the rational soul. Now, with that said, we do know that the devil and demons, as well as even righteous angels, do have the ability to affect things that pertain to us within the physical aspect of us, namely our bodies, and even within those aspects of us that are restricted to material stuff, like our imagination. So they can, you know, sort of present images, mental images that we sort of see in our mind's eye. That's not the intellect itself, that's the imagination, and they do have access to that. So, you know, within God's providential plan, he does permit at times demons to affect us in that way. Whether that can be done for an infant in the womb concerning the imagination itself, I'd have to think through that a little bit more. Not quite sure exactly how developed the imagination. I mean, the imagination of an infant in the womb is going to be extremely limited in what it can do, because there's not a whole lot of sense knowledge that's coming into the imagination for the infant's imagination to work on and work with. Consequently, you know, a demon or even a righteous angel would have limited capabilities of manipulating the infant's imagination. So that's with regard to the realm of the imagination. Technically speaking, purely spiritual beings, whether righteous or unrighteous, demons or angels, have the ability to affect material stuff and even our bodies within the world. Can that happen in principle where they're affecting the physical body of an infant in the womb? I can't think of anything that would rule it out and like say, no, it is metaphysically impossible. But I do caution you or anybody listening to think that this would be a normal, ordinary course of events. Whenever there are any sort of genetic defects or material defects in the development of the body of an infant in the womb or any of us, right? That's often more so than not due to just simply the defectibility of the material world as a whole. Whenever you have material beings, material substances like we are as body-soul composites, matter is going to mess up sometimes. And that's a mystery as to why God permits material developments to not achieve in a successful way. That is a mystery of why God permits that and doesn't perform a miracle to impede or to stop that defect and make the material development succeed. But material defects do happen. And so that is the case. We know whether that's coming from like a demon or something, in principle, that's possible. I can't think of anything offhand to rule that out, but I would not be inclined to say that this is something that happens very often. It would be extremely rare circumstances for whatever reason in God's providential plan he permits such an activity of a demon in order to bring about some greater good for the good of the whole. But that's as far as I can go with that, Juan.
Okay, Juan.
Thank you. Yes, thank you very much, and I do apologize. I didn't mean it in that way.
No.
More in the sense of just yes.
You were absolutely fine, Juan. It's just that there are certain things that I know are sensitive subjects, and I just got to be really careful about them. But you were just fine. No problem at all. Going to go to.
I really appreciate it. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Juan. I'm going to go to Louisiana and Claire in Louisiana, and I'm going to tell you something, Carlo. I think you have developed a younger fan set. wait a second. Hang on. Claire, are you there?
Yes, sir.
Well, Claire, how old are you?
7.
Claire, this is, I am having a great day because you are the third 7-year-old I've gotten to speak to today.
Fourth child.
This is a fourth child, third 7-year-old.
Yeah, it's like kids day for Carlo.
I'm so glad you called. Go ahead with your question for Mr. Broussard. Oh, by the way, Claire, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but he's from Louisiana as well.
Woohoo! My fellow Cajun. Claire, how can I help you?
Go ahead, Claire, with your question.
Did Jesus actually turn the bread and wine actually into his body and blood before the crucifixion?
Oh, man.
Excellent.
It was all these seven-year-old theologians.
Question,
you are so
Claire.
Smart, Claire.
Yes.
All right, here's your answer.
And so here's the answer, Claire. The answer is yes, he did actually change bread and wine into his body and blood at the Last Supper before his crucifixion. Now, here's the key, Claire. Here's how we got to understand this. He changed it in a way that we might not think he changes other things. So think of this, Claire. Remember that Bible story which talks about how Jesus at the wedding of Cana, when he takes water. And Claire, do you remember what he changes water into?
Okay. Hang on. I think I put Claire on hold.
I was trying to have a conversation with
you. I'm so sorry. I didn't know he was going to become a two-way chat. Claire, do you remember what Jesus turned the water into?
Wine.
Woohoo! Yes. Good job, Claire. I'm glad you got it. All right. So notice how in that change, he changed water into actual wine. But notice that after the change, the people actually saw wine. They no longer saw water. And they tasted wine. And they no longer tasted water, okay? Well, with the Eucharist, Claire, there's a real change that goes on, just like when Jesus changed water into wine. So there is a real change. But what's different, Claire, in this change, the change of the Eucharist, is that what we see after the change is still bread. That's what we see. Although we know from Jesus' teaching, it's not really bread. And what we taste after the change is bread. But that's only what we taste. It's not really bread because of what Jesus tells us. So there is a real change where before Jesus says, this is my body and this is my blood, bread and wine are there. After Jesus says, this is my body and this is my blood, guess what, Claire? Bread and wine are no longer present. They're no longer there. And it is only Jesus's body and blood that's present. But under the appearance of what we see to be bread and what we taste to be bread, what we see to be wine and what we taste to be wine. And that's a miracle, Claire. That's actually God exercising his God creator power to do this kind of thing, to make this kind of change, like water into wine, but differently, where the appearance of the bread and the wine is actually going to remain the same.
What do you think, Claire? Was that a good answer?
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir.
Okay. All right. I appreciate that.
Thank you, Claire, for calling.
Claire, I hope you will call again. That was a real, we're lucky we got to talk to you, and we'll be lucky the next time we get to talk to you, too. Thank you very, very much for that call. I think I can get another call on, Carlos, so I'm going to do my very best. You want to pick a number? Just pick any, whatever.
I guess.
Our number's hard for you to pick?
You pick.
Yeah. All right.
I don't know.
All right. Dominic in Texas, listening on Guadalupe Radio. We're glad you're here, Dominic. Go ahead with your question for Carlo.
So, I was always told that Jesus told his apostles that you're hearing what I'm saying, but you're not listening, but I have yet to find what verse that is.
Yeah, I don't know, Dominic. we might be ending on the last question of the 2 hours with stumping me here. I mean, one thing that comes to mind is, you know, in the Bible where it talks about Jesus talking about how people have eyes to see and ears to hear. Where that's at in the Bible.
Matthew 13.
Matthew 13, thank you.
I think so. Si.
Yeah. That would be one location where I would possibly go to look for this, but I'm going to have to bow in humility here, Dominic, and say I don't know what exactly which Bible passage you would be referring to here, and I'd have to do a little bit of research to try to figure it out.
Yeah, the one in Matthew 13 is the one where he's explaining why he speaks in parables.
Is that
what you're looking for, Dominic? Yeah.
Well, I thought it might be going back to the Sermon on the Mount, but when I went back and read that, it isn't word for word. And yeah. Actually, one of the priests here in Texas, it was one of the readings, and then or maybe it wasn't a reading, but he would reference it along with the gospel or, you know, one of the readings.
Right.
And he kind of said the same thing. But, you know, our mom had always told us, you know, God's talking to you, but you're not listening.
Well, let me ask you this, Dominic. You live in Texas. So are there any Baptists near you? You got any Baptists?
Oh, yeah, there's plenty of Baptists down
here. Ask them. They'll know where the Bible passage is.
well, here's a few of them. So, for example, a quick search, Dominic. Matthew 11:15, he who has ears to hear, let him hear. Mark 4:9, he who has ears to hear, let him hear. That's Mark's version, right? Mark 4:23, if any man has ears to hear, let him hear. The idea here, Dominic, is that some people will be properly and rightly disposed to receive the truth that Jesus is giving. Some people will not. And that's what the passage is getting at. So we need to ask for God's grace to be disposed to receive God's truth and hear his word.
Dominic, thanks. Sorry to those we did not get to today. Well, but I know that we'll have lines open again Thursday. You know, Tuesdays and Thursdays we do open forum generally. Although I'm not even sure if we're doing open forum Thursday this week. I know we got an open forum but it's an internet open forum tomorrow with Joe Heschmeyer. So thanks very much. Carlo, 2 great hours. Thank you very much.
It was a blast.
How many 7-year-olds did you end up talking to? 3 7-year-olds?
3 and a 9-year-old.
3 7-year-olds and a 9-year-old. That adds up to 1 adult. We'll see you tomorrow, God willing, right here on Catholic Answers Live.